This episode is made possible by Awin. Two-thirds of digital ad spend currently flows to the three big tech platforms, Google, Meta, and Amazon. But their auction-based ad models favor their own bottom line and inflate costs at a time when every single marketing dollar counts. Awin's affiliate partnerships platform offers a real alternative to big tech and puts you back in control of your ad spend. Want to find out how? Visit awin.com/emarketer to learn more. Hello, everyone, and thanks for hanging out with us for the Behind the Numbers weekly listen and eMarketer podcast made possible by Awin. This is the Friday show that does not endorse Oscar's Barcelona shirt.
I'm glad you noticed.
I'm just glad it's not a video podcast, to be honest, Oscar.
Okay. Should be.
So people don't have to look at that.
Just tell them how beautiful it is, Marcus.
It's pretty nice. Subscribe. It's pretty nice. I'm your host, Marcus Johnson, in today's show. Google turns 25.
So even if it's less culturally relevant, and maybe if it's not where the next viral trend is happening, it's where the money's pouring in.
How do Americans feel about stores?
People want to go to stores, they will go to stores, but you have to give them a good experience, right? And this is like such an obvious takeaway.
Subway introduces a new tiered rewards program.
What makes a loyalty program, rewards program, really elite is when it's automatically applied. And I don't see that enough.
How Hispanics feel their values are reflected by American brands. Will your Uber drivers soon be robots? And some very interesting quirks about American geography. Join me for this episode. We have three people. Let's meet them. We start with our senior forecasting analyst based out of Colorado. It's Zach Goldner.
Hey, Marcus. Thanks for having me.
Yes, sir. We're also joined by our principal forecasting writer based in New York. It's Ethan Kramer Flood.
You keep inviting me back and I keep showing up.
I don't know why. I think Victoria is responsible. We're also joined by one of our directors of forecasting based out of New York as well. It's Oscar Orozco.
Hello, everybody.
Somehow you made it back too, Oscar. Who invited? Who set out the guest list for this one? Anyway, what do we have in store for you? Well, we're going to talk about Google turning 25. That's the story of the week. Then we move to the game of the week, where our contestants will try to win the championship belt, and we end with some random trivia. Let's get into it. We start, of course, with the story of the week. So Google turns 25. That was the recent title of an NPR article. It explained that Google was founded 25 years ago by two Stanford PhD students, Larry Page and Sergey Brin. The company went on to shape the internet and now, after a quarter century, finds itself at a turning point. With the rise of AI and social media platforms like TikTok, its continued dominance is not assured, the NPR piece suggests. Gents, Google's just turned 25 somehow. What stands out to you the most about this kind of marquee birthday?
It struck me that this is a poorly timed birthday for Google because it gives tech journalists and commentators an opportunity to write these massive retrospectives that inevitably are unflattering. And this is it coming out at a time when Google is already facing lots and lots of problems and lots of negative attention, government regulatory actions and lawsuits, and seems to be buffeted on all fronts. And now we've got this 25th birthday, which enables all of these people to reflect upon the good old days when Google was a great company and when we all enjoyed its search functionality and it was so smooth and elegant and it was so useful and what a great utility it used to be. And now it is this horrible, nightmarish experience for all of us and they've all gone downhill and yada, yada, and everybody has all these memories. And I was like, well, if it hadn't been their 25th birthday, I wouldn't be reading this right now. So bad timing, but what can you do?
Speaking of the big bad 25, it's almost as if Google is getting kicked off its parents' health plan. You hear that, mom and dad? Google search is pretty old. And at this point, it's the U.S. government that's the one that's kicking it off the health plan. But what that means is the parents, as in the U.S. government, is getting pretty strict with Google. Google, at this point, still controls 90% of search advertising in the U.S. So even if it's less culturally relevant, and maybe if it's not where the next viral trend is happening, it's where the money's pouring in. Yes, there's a concern of whether it's able to hold up that 90% share moving forward with the oncoming use of AI. But as of right now, Google search is a cash cow. Everyone uses it in their daily habit. But 25, Google is still running really strong. Not going anywhere.
I agree with both of you guys here. I was actually worried that we might have an argument here today, guys. And it's good to see we're on the same page. I think, you know, I'm a bit more nostalgic, I think, than all of you guys. You might know that from hearing me on the show before. But it is crazy how quickly the 25 years have come and gone. But I'm on the same page. I think it's way too early to write Google off. I think what Zach said about, yeah, maybe those big viral moments aren't happening on Google. It's happening on the TikToks and the Instagram and the social platforms, which get a little bit more of the buzz. But the reality of it is, you know, when you look at the stats, and that's kind of what I looked at, you talked about the money they're raking in, $74 billion in net ad revenue next year, 26% of all digital ad spending. I mean, when we look at Google Assistant, we estimate that 88 million Americans use Google Assistant. 36 million use Google Pay. About 130 million plus Americans have an Android device. YouTube users, we have that at over 2.4 billion. This is worldwide across the globe. So the scale, the reach of Google is unprecedented, and it's not falling, if at all. So it just feels a little overblown, all of this. And it's what Ethan said. It's the time to have a retrospective, to look back. But, you know, Google is in a strong position.
This is why I like appearing on these shows with other forecasters, because they will bring it strong with the data points, and I don't have to. You know, I can just kind of like shoot from the hip,
because
I know that Oscar and Zach are going to have numbers for me.
And as an honorary Gen Z member here, I just want to state, people are not using TikTok for their business lookups and their business searches. Yeah, they might be trying to look up cat videos on there, but what share of the search ad market is that going to take up? Very few. I don't think it's something that Google should be all too worried about moving forward.
The dollars haven't headed over, but it does seem that TikTok is the preferred search platform for younger folks. So 75% of Gen Z people using TikTok as a search platform, just over half, 51%, saying TikTok is their preferred search engine over Google. This was a survey from Her Campus Media. TikTok also introducing Wikipedia snippets within its search results to try to make it a little bit better. But so it does seem as though folks, younger folks, are using TikTok more and more. And yes, Google's still very relevant and they still have the majority of the ad dollars, but that could change pretty quickly. And actually, it seems like the search ad dollars are changing in the US. So Google currently has over 50% to Amazon's 22%. Microsoft, Apple, they each have 5% share. That's according to you guys. That's our forecast. But that 30% gap between Google and Amazon will fall to a 20% gap, 20-point gap, in just 2 years. So that is heading rapidly in the wrong direction. Now, the dollars are still going up for Google. Yes, the pie is getting bigger. But it does seem like some of that dominance is waning, especially in search ad dollars in the US.
So, to me, the real existential threat for Google here is not so much that there are other ways to find what we want to find out there, and that, you know, those folks can therefore sell advertising against whatever it is that people are searching for on their platforms. It's just that Google itself, the experience on Google itself, is not what it used to be. Those retrospective writers that are talking about the good old days when you would go to google.com and it would produce this elegant result that would give you exactly what you needed, and it was sort of, you know, the ideal version of what a website is supposed to be, because it was just there entirely to make your life easier and to organize the world's information and give you what you want as quickly as possible. You know, and that's not the case anymore, right? It is a busy, messy sort of result strewn page full of headache-inducing advertisements, and instead of giving you what you want, it gives you what it wants. And you know, we all have a more difficult time with Google search than we probably used to, but that's just the nature of the beast now. So the threat to Google is that it has become less pleasant to use their search as compared to how it used to be, but they're not going to lose advertising revenue off of that, because as Amazon or TikTok take those ads, then their search becomes less pleasant as well. And the same thing happens to everybody, right? Amazon.com also used to be one of the most elegant, well-maintained websites, and that has also become a nightmare, right? This is just how things happen when they grow up, and the way that we use the internet has changed. I don't think Google's in trouble at all. I think they're going to be fine, but that doesn't mean the criticism isn't valid.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, a lot of the criticism is about Google's lack of innovation a few years, but I think it seems like they're in a lose-lose, that people are just, they just want to criticize, pile it on. So if they do lose a little bit of search share, which is happening, our data does show that, doesn't that mean that they might be focusing more of their attention on the cloud and on other parts of their business, right, where they might see more opportunity for innovation? So I think you have to analyze the situation in a more holistic way, looking at their different different business segments and how those are doing. It's not just a search story. And in that sense, search, as Ethan has said, and I agree totally, is changing for everyone. So we have to analyze Google in a more, you know, even keel fashion.
I do want to give one caveat real quickly to this. Google has entered into binding agreements with Apple and Mozilla Firefox to be the default browser on those different apps. So people are immediately going to, it eliminates the choice as well. So that's a lot of where the whole monopoly question is coming from with that Google.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of the monopoly question, so Ryan Broderick of The Verge saying that for two decades, Google search was the invisible force that determined the ebb and flow of online content. Now its cultural relevance is in question. And so I'm wondering, even though we don't think any of these competitors are close to killing off Google, who's the biggest threat here? Do we think that it is Amazon? Say, most people starting their product searches on Amazon, have done for a short while now, and it's not particularly close either, according to Jungle Scout. So do we think it's Amazon? Do we think it's TikTok? Do we think it's ChatGPT? Who should Google be most worried about at this point? Maybe someone else?
Will search remain as vital as it used to be now that the internet is such a mature place and internet users already know what they want, right? We used to need to go to Google to find anything. And now you don't really start your web browsing experience on Google very often because you already know where to go. There's a million other, if you're shopping, you're going somewhere else. For social media, you're going somewhere else. For information, you're going to Wikipedia or a news, whatever. You already know what you're going to be doing. So if you combine the general sort of decline in the necessity of search with things like AI, you know, and increasing the utility of what Bing can offer or even what Google can offer, it just seems going to, like, there's potentially just going to be less searching in the future.
I was going to mention at the beginning of the year, Google gave a code red once OpenAI released ChatGPT. I think it's going to be looking at AI and different competitors, those being the main competitors. And that still does include in those big tech players like Microsoft or Meta as well, which is coming out, that's new open sourced AI platform too. That's going to be where they lose out on some of its search revenue. Google's going to have to focus on Google Bard, where it's not able to pull in some of the aggregate data from that of the socials, from that of Meta or that of Twitter or X. And that's where it's going to face troubles moving forward.
I mean, I was going to agree with my colleagues here. I mean, to me, it's entirely what search, let's call it search 2.0, is going to look like. And that's just the ChatGPT story. So whatever that looks like, that's really, to me, where the biggest competition or where Google needs to be focused more on, because that's where the biggest shifts are happening and they can't fall behind there. So aside from, you know, attributing the competition directly to a particular platform, it's without a doubt generative AI.
People across ages are searching differently. Statista had some numbers, 2019 to 2022, the share of people 18 to 64, so most folks who research purchases on Google, fell from 64% to 54%. And over that time, social media went from 20 to 24. That said, Google owns search. I think, Zach, you said it. At the top, it's not remotely close. Google's worldwide search market share, excluding China, where it's banned, and Russia, where it pulled out, is 91%. Bing has 3, Yahoo has 3, and the other folks have 3 collectively. That's as of June 2023, according to SimilarWeb data. And in the US, similar story, Zach mentioned, Google has 90%, Bing has 5, Yahoo has 2%. And we'll keep an eye on this US Justice Department civil antitrust suit against Google for monopolizing digital ad technologies. We are going to try to have put together an episode on that, looking into the details of that case and what we expect the fallout to be in the next couple of weeks. That's all we've got time for the story of the week. Time for the game of the week. Today's game, what's the point? I read out 4 stories and Zach, Oscar and Ethan give me their best take. Passable answers get 1 point, respectable answers get 2. And answers that give you the same feeling as Oscar, this one isn't for you. A dog greeting you when you walk in the door. Oscar hates dogs.
Never experienced it.
Is it? You hate dogs?
Never want to.
Oh man, this is quite the revelation.
I do not.
Yeah,
quite revelation.
Oscar doesn't deserve dogs.
Oh my god. This is all exaggerated. He hates dogs.
Are great. Well, actually, I've got another one for you, though, because Oscar hates dogs. So answers that give you the same feeling as holding an adorable little puppy. Actually, no, that doesn't work either. Oscar hates puppies, too.
Yeah, no,
mint chocolate chip. Are you going to give me that one, Marcus?
He really likes you. He kicks puppies.
You're the worst person. Okay, how about this one? A 2-0 start for the San Francisco 49ers.
Yeah.
Oscar's team, for some reason, it's not the same. The best answers will get you 3 points. 20 seconds to answer before you hear this. If you run long and get teed up, 2 technicals gets you ejected from the game. Most points wins. Let's play. We start with Ethan for round 1. Retailers bet wrong on America's feelings about stores, writes Amanda Mull of The Atlantic. She writes that the internet was supposed to kill in-person shopping. But have you been to a Bass Pro? She explains that the 32-story metal pyramid in downtown Memphis, Tennessee, once home to the NBA's Memphis Grizzlies, is about 5 times as large as the average Walmart and now houses the largest Bass Pro Shops store. You can buy hunting and camping gear, you can stay in its 100-room hotel, you can fish for sturgeon, or you can eat at its Wahlberg's restaurant chain. But Ethan, retailers betting wrong, perhaps, on Americans' feelings about stores, what's the point?
Yeah, I mean, well, the point of this article is that we like stores and people want to go to stores. And although most are not going to be able to emulate that Bass Pro Shop in Memphis that's the size of an NBA arena, people want to go to stores. They will go to stores, but you have to give them a good experience, right? And this is like such an obvious takeaway for any of us, anyone in New York right now, like I am, we go into normal retail shops and there's like nobody working there. You know, you have to hire people. We need employees. You know, if it's a good, positive experience, if the store is clean, if you can get in, get out, you can get your questions answered, the line isn't 20 minutes long, it's going to be great. People are going to be happy, but you have to make it, it has to be a positive experience. And that's what Bass has figured out. And I wish that all the stores around me would figure that out because I'd be delighted to use their services.
Zach.
Yeah, retailers need to have an omnichannel experience. They have to both have the online product, online experience where someone can do their research, and order a product after experiencing in person. But so even despite the convenience of shopping online, people still really do desire that in-person experience. And that comes to fruition, especially when it comes to trying out a product. You can think of different products like that of Casper mattresses or Warby Parker glasses that both start off as D2C companies that started to introduce their own retail brick and mortar shops where people could try that on and see if they like it. And whether they order the product online or at the store, it doesn't matter. They'll eventually make the purchase.
Oscar.
Yeah, I agree with the guys here. I think the first thing I thought about was the shopping mall. And I think, I've personally been researching, you know, supposedly the demise of the shopping mall since the Great Recession. It's been a long time now. It has not come to fruition. I mean, I was looking at some data from Placer.ai that found that, sure, indoor malls visits dropped 30% between 2019 and 2021. But what's happened since then? Traffic has bounced back. So just a lot of data out there that shows people really do enjoy the in-store experience if it's done right.
Mm-hmm. You can check out an upcoming episode of our Reimagining Retail show coming out October 4th, where we'll dive into what makes a good retail store. So stay tuned for that one. We move to round 2. We start with Zach. Subway introduces a tiered rewards program, notes our senior retail briefings analyst Zach Stambor. He explains that Subway is replacing its My Way rewards program with over 30 million members with a new multi-tiered MVP rewards program that offers enhanced rewards when consumers reach 200 and 400 in annual spend. Subway will move those existing folks over to the new program. But Zach, Subway introducing a tiered rewards program, what's the point?
I think that they add an element of excitement. People love their games and rewards. Think about that 10 punch pass you have for your local coffee shop. People want to get that number 10 so they can get free coffee, or they want to play McDonald's Monopoly. Anyways, different incentives like this, they are able to track over time. They realize, oh, if I'm able to reach X amount of dollars, then I get this kind of discount on it. So my recommendation is for people to go to Subway, put their lunch on their corporate card, and rise those ranks.
Oscar.
It's a great, great recommendation. I mean, I agree about the gamification aspect of it. We've been talking about that since, early on in the pandemic and how that's grown. But to me, what makes a loyalty program, rewards program, really elite is when it's automatically applied. And I don't see that enough. But I think that's the insinuation of what I'm reading into with the Subway program. I think if shoppers have these sort of rewards come in automatically, I think that's really the way to go, because these rewards programs are difficult to navigate, and you know, that's really what holds them back from growing. So that's what these brands need to do.
Ethan.
All I could think about when I read this article, this announcement, is that I really just don't go to Subway nearly as much as I used to. Shout out to Zach for advocating that everyone like jump on this. You know, the $200 per year was the level at which significant benefits started to kick in. And I was thinking, boy, before the pandemic, I would have hit that, like no problem, because I'd go to the office all the time and then you got to get lunch and I would end up at Subway because, you know, you do. And now I just don't. I wouldn't come anywhere close to hitting that anymore. It's not Subway's fault. I like them. They do a good job, but our lives have changed and I don't go there anymore. So this is, you know, if they can figure out how to get people back into offices, this would really take off.
Quick thing. I'm curious if this incentive itself has to do with, I believe Subway just sold to another owner.
I saw that.
I wonder if this is like their first initiative that they're taking. Food for thought.
Possibly. Zach Stambaugh, who wrote the piece, pointing out that over the past few years, a lot of major chains, Dunkin', PF Chang's, Sweetgreen, have all introduced multi-tiered rewards programs to boost loyalty. We are at the halfway mark, and Zach and Oscar tied with 4 apiece, Ethan just behind with 3. We start with Oscar for round 3. Hispanics feel disregarded by American culture and big brands, notes a recent Portada article. Findings from the Hispanic Sentiment Study reveal a worrying drop in how Latinos feel their values are shared or reflected by most Americans and big brands. Less than half, 48% of Latinos, feel their values are shared and reflected by most Americans. That's a 20-point drop from 2018, where it was 68%. And 45% of Latinos think big brands represented their values, down 9 points from 54 in 2018. But Oscar, Hispanics feeling disregarded by American culture and big brands, what's the point?
You know, speaking from experience, I think this study actually truly reflects how the general Hispanic community is feeling. But I'd like to say a quick thing on this. According to the census in 2020, so it's probably increased since here, about 19% of the U.S. population is classified as Hispanic, over 62 million Americans. That's a lot of people. I do think that there's this overgeneralization. We've been talking about marketing to Hispanics for a long time as well. And it's a lot of people. It's people that hail from different continents, 20 plus countries, different walks of life and cultural experiences. And I think that's honestly what this study reflects, is that it's very hard and probably the wrong thing to bucket them all into one type of person and think of them that way, because there are many, many differences. So it makes a lot of sense to me that these numbers are down across the board.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people, Oscar, and to that point, it's grown significantly. 16% share in 2010, now closer to a 19% share. That's an additional 10 million people. That's basically about a million new folks in this demographic added to the U.S. population every single year. Ethan.
Yeah, $2 trillion in purchasing power. So nothing to snub at here. The takeaway for me for this one was just the downward trajectory on the results. So it's not so surprising that you would have negative answers to a survey like this. I think you would actually find negative results almost any way you slice it when you do a sort of a demographic, any category or subcategory. If you ask people, like, what do you think of the national media? What do you think of multinational companies and brands, right? You tend to get negative results no matter what, you know, age group, race, religion, nationality, gender you're talking to. But in this case, it was like, oh, it's getting worse all the time, right? So things are heading in the wrong direction for whatever reason. There is this opportunity set though, right? So when the question became more specific about certain individual brands or individual media, you had more positive results, which is again, the kind of thing you would find in other demographic surveys as well. So, you know, this can be resolved if people put effort into it. And yeah, 2 trillion. I mean, come on, folks, get on it.
Yeah. Zach.
I think Oscar and Ethan both hit home here. I just want to reiterate what Oscar said. Over 60 million Hispanic people in the U.S. So that's not a small amount. Something companies need to look towards. What the survey also mentioned is that small companies have done a better job at attracting these Hispanic audiences. So it's something that bigger brands need to look forward to, that they need to be their authentic selves. Instead of chasing after what the next big awareness campaign is for that month, I think they need to be authentic. What that means is investing in bilingual advertising, cultural insights, and knowing it's not a one-size-fits-all for the Hispanic community, and that way that they'd be able to reach these audiences.
Nice game so far, gents. We moved to double points round four, and Zach and Oscar still just 1 point ahead of Ethan. But it's double points round four, of course, all to play for. Ethan will start. Round four, cherish your Uber drivers. Soon they will be robots, suggests an article from The Economist. It explains that the article was written whilst riding in the back of a Waymo self-driving taxi in San Francisco, an office on wheels, it says. The robo-taxi arrives once you summon it through an app. It arrives showing your initials on a display on the roof. You wave at it to make it stop. You climb in once it finds a safe place to pull over. The piece notes that after years of testing, Alphabet-owned Waymo and its rival Cruise, owned mostly by GM, got permission from California regulators in August to sell driverless taxi rides across San Francisco in one of up to 500 available vehicles. But Ethan, Uber drivers may be becoming robots soon. What's the point?
You know, I'm jealous of the people who write these. Every time I read an article like this, I'm like, oh, man. But, you know, here's the thing about living in New York. When you're in New York City, and Oscar's in this boat with me, we either experience things before everyone else in the world or just dead last. And they're like, there's nothing in between, right? For like fashion or music or devices or new kinds of food, like we're first. This is the best place to be. But for this, like it's never, I have no idea. It's going to be years before we get this in New York City. It's not going to come here. I'm never going to have any sort of insightful thing to say about what this is like, because I can't even imagine a scenario when New York City starts to, like, they're going to be in every other, like, Zach is in the boonies in Colorado. He's going to get to ride a driverless taxi before I do. I have no idea what's going on here. But, you know, I can't wait until someday, like 20 years from now, when I get to ride one.
Is the point you need to move? Is that what?
No, because I'm here for I'm here for the food and the music and the fashion. I'm not here for driverless taxis.
All right, fair enough. Zach.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of different benefits of this automation of driverless car. The thing is, consumers, they're scared of it at this point. I think you may have heard in other articles, people are putting over driving traffic cones on top of those Waymo cars to stop them from going. But my takeaway from this is, what's going to stop automakers from producing these cars themselves, these driverless taxis? Think about Uber or Ford. What's going to stop them from using their own autopilot technology and starting their own taxi companies? Just food for thought.
Yeah. In terms of the people putting cones on these cars, so yeah, not everyone sold. It's an anonymous activist group called Safe Street Rebel. They're protesting driverless cars in their city in San Francisco, putting traffic cones on the hoods of the cars, the bonnet, if you're not in America, hoods of cars to confuse their sensors and immobilize them. Oscar.
To Ethan's point, it's also a by choice thing. Would I ever choose to get into one of these in New York City if I had the choice to? Absolutely not. I think Zach mentioned it. I mean, I pulled some data on this from AAA that found that 68% of Americans are afraid of self-driving cars, and that's jumped up. That's jumped up from 2022, where it was at 55%. Just 9% of Americans say they trust these cars. So we're a long way from really making these feel like a comforting type of, you know, experience for people that are hailing cabs. So we're a long way from these really catching on. We even have our own forecasts that show, you know, it's really only caught on in San Francisco, a little bit maybe in Austin, Miami. So this feels very, very, very far off from anything that's going to happen.
Oscar soon. And Ethan, be real with yourselves. Are you comfortable with a New York taxi driver driving you around? Are you comfortable?
Yes.
Is that the word you use?
Absolutely. They are the best drivers in the world.
This doesn't have anything to do with safety for me. I would happily get into one of those driverless vehicles. I just don't think that they're going to be able to manage New York. I think it would go 5 feet and it would be, its brain would be fried and overwhelmed.
So you
with
are
the amount
scared.
Of hospital. No,
you
I
are
just
scared
stop.
Of an accident.
I don't think it's going to work. You're like, I can't even get down the street. You know, I wouldn't get where I was going.
It would be too much for it to take in, perhaps.
I can see Oscar secretly being a taxi medallion holder himself and that being a side
gig.
Oh,
man. Yeah, don't even get me started on the interest groups that are going to stand in the way of this year. I mean, we didn't even let Uber and Lyft have competitive pricing, right? I mean, there's so many standing in the way of this.
Oscar moonlighting as a cab driver.
I've heard of weirder things. Yeah. Never know.
The safety concerns are interesting here because any time that this thing, one of these things does go wrong, it makes headlines. An NPR article from Dara Kerr was noting that driverless cars have run red lights, rear-ended a bus, blocked crosswalks and bike paths. But that's, it sounds like they've behaved pretty similar to how humans already behave. And humans are responsible for 40,000 car crash deaths every year. And so it's, you would think that the bar would be pretty low in terms of trying to improve upon that horrific number. But because it's a very new technology, it is just going to take people a bit longer to get used to them, even if their safety rates are higher. We'll see. That's all we've got time for the game of the week. This week's winner, drumroll, Oscar! Ooh. This week's winner of the game of the week. Very close. Neck and neck with Zach going into the final round. Paul's ahead, 12 points. Zach, 10. Ethan, 7.
I demand.
Was that Zach?
I demand an audit. This is.
It's funny how what's going on here? No, I haven't been here in a month and we're all getting competitive.
No, just kidding. You earned it.
Thank you. Zach, I also heard that.
Turning into Susie, even.
What?
That's, or maybe it was his Ethan. Heard some sort of sigh. It's in. Oh,
congratulations,
it's been a while, Marcus.
Championship belt, it has indeed. And you get the last word.
Last word. Came prepared. Well.
Oh, hello. Expecting to win, well.
not really. Not really. I just wanted to, I usually talk about either sports or shows. It's my time to recommend a good show we just started watching on Peacock. Not really a platform I've watched shows on before. I think
Love Island?
Premier League.
It's amazing.
No. I wouldn't talk about that publicly. Right. But it's called Poker Face.
Privately, it's all he messages me about. Poker Face, okay.
Pretty much. Poker Face, we started season one. Natasha Lyonne is brilliant in it. It has kind of like a, I wouldn't say like an all-star cast, but they rotate in very well-known actors for every week or every episode. And it's really entertaining. It's kind of funny. It's really engaging. So if you're looking for anything to watch, totally would recommend it on Peacock.
I don't know why, Oscar, but for some reason, when you give these recommendations, they seem very promotional. It's like maybe you were the director of the film.
Is he getting paid? I don't get a cut of anything over here.
It's just naturally, I'm very, okay. Just super into it.
Oscar
super
directs on the side as well as drives a cab as well. Around New
from
York
from the
City.
Cab.
All right, that's what
cash
we've got time
cab.
For.
Remember Cash Cab. Yeah.
That's what we've got time for. But the game of the week, congratulations to Oscar. He is this week's winner. It's time now for Dinner Party Data. This is the part of the show where we tell you about the most interesting thing we've learned this week. We start with Oscar because he won. What you got for us, mate?
Yes. Well, I came across the last time you yelled at me, Marcus, because I was talking about something
like
work-related. Remember that?
Oh,
so
yeah.
I tried to steer very clear from
episode.
That. Yeah, it was terrible. So this one's about a fascinating study, you know, me. Sometimes it's weird stuff, but it was about finding out. It was actually reported by the Wall Street Journal. It was a study in Italy that found a correlation between severe COVID risk and finding the Neanderthal gene in the people that they studied, the samples. This was in Bergamo, Italy. And they were trying to figure out why this city was hit so hard by COVID. I know COVID's something we talk less and less about, but it still feels relevant, of course. And they found, looked into a sample of 10,000 people from Bergamo, Italy, which was hit very hard, and found that there was an increased risk of severe COVID which actually meant having like intense pneumonia and higher hospitalization in the intensive care units. But if they had this Neanderthal haplotype, so it was like, I think, 3 times more likely that people got sick if they had it.
Wow.
So I found that to be very fascinating because
it seems
it's crazy that they're very high, but also that they could even track that, you know, that the fact that people have Neanderthal haplotype still. Apparently in Europe and in Asia, about 2% on average of people have some sort of Neanderthal haplotype genes. So found that to be very, very fascinating. But the other thing that I thought of was, now that we've figured this out, I feel like academia should be putting all their research dollars into figuring out if we can sort of find any other correlation with really bizarre behaviors that other humans, that humans have, and see if that's related back to that Neanderthal gene, perhaps. No offense to Neanderthals, of course, but if we could figure that out, that means we'd have some sort of cure, right?
No offense to Neanderthals.
No offense to Neanderthals.
None taken.
That's the second thing I thought of. Really cool stuff.
That is pretty cool. It's remarkable what you can find in people's DNA, like through this is through the blood test?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's amazing what you can find out. You'd be like, you, sir, are sick and also a Jets fan, which we found out through the blood test.
We might be able to figure that out.
Yeah. Yes, we could tell that because you came in crying. And we just assumed that you were a Jets fan.
Exactly.
Very nice, very nice. Let's move to Ethan.
Sure, I've got a short one for you now, and it's about the Hollywood strikes that are going on. Still, I was hanging out this weekend with an entertainment industry buddy of mine who is on strike with the actors, actually, and it was suddenly occurring to me how long this has been going on. It really is quite severe at this point, I think more so than a lot of us expected. And so I was like, boy, this is going to matter for 2024. We're at the point now that, you know, season 2 of Poker Face isn't going to be happening and all the other stuff that we're waiting for, next year, what are we going to be doing? So I was wondering how long it had been going on and what the longest strike ever was so we could get some assessment of what kind of ramifications. So this has been going on for about 4.5 months now, somewhere into the 140 something day degree, which indeed is very long. And the longest writers strike of all time was in 1988, and it was 154 days. So we are extremely close to this being the longest strike in Hollywood history among the writers. Of course, the actors only joined in July, but the writers have been going on since May. So we are very close to uncharted territory. Mm-hmm. This length of a shutdown just hasn't happened before. So who knows what next year is going to be like. There doesn't seem to be any progress. It doesn't seem to be nearly being solved. But I think a lot of us that thought that this wasn't really going to matter that much for TV and streaming services for next year were probably wrong. I think this probably is going to matter.
Yeah. Me and Paul Werner were talking about this and about how, the fall window has pretty much been missed. And even if they turned on the taps today and got a deal done, by the time they got production back up and seasons recorded, the new content really wouldn't hit the shelves until maybe end of Q1, start of Q2, maybe. But a lot of this is going to carry over into next summer already, and it doesn't look like they're close to a deal. So people might have forgotten a bit about this because it's fallen out of the headlines, and it doesn't affect everyone who's not directly involved. But I think once the new content kind of doesn't start flowing next year, people and those season 2s, season 3s, whatever, new movies don't start hitting people's screens, they will start to notice a lot more. Zach, you're up.
My data point comes from a personal story of mine. Well, today I did not get nearly enough sleep as I should have, so naturally I looked up sleep facts. Well, fun enough, the average person spends 26 years of their life sleeping, and so I thought, who's the lucky person of who slept the most that I can maybe take some inspiration from? And his name is Randy Gardner. Back in 1965, he slept for a record 11 days and 25 minutes. I don't care for 11 days. What? Maybe a few more hours.
11 days?
Days.
Straight? Is Randy a brown bear? What do you mean he's
slept for 11 days? He's a 17-year-old boy that probably took his ACT.
He sounds like something was up with Randy. Did someone check a pulse or
severe medical situation? He's asleep. It's fine.
Should we check on Randy? He's fine. It's fine. Sleeping off.
Randy was in a coma.
Well, it said 11, it sounds a lot like a number of side effects coming from it: hallucinations, memory loss, and concentrating. But after a few days, who knows? Maybe he got some more sleep in that time. He fully recovered.
If you sleep for 11
hours, is this verified by Guinness? Or else I don't believe it.
Look at us.
I was told a while ago that we do not fact check dinner party data. Marcus is not like it.
Not
if
mine.
Anyone asks any questions.
Please. Yeah. I don't need that kind of heat. All right. Let's move on to the last one.
Oh,
I've got one for
you.
There's more.
Back up. I guess I completely. That's the most amount of time someone's been awake for. My apologies.
Oh my
God. Fact check myself.
Well, that ruins the entire
thing. That makes a little more sense.
Leave this as is.
This is our senior forecasting analyst, folks. He gives you the numbers that you rely on.
I mean, it feels like it's equally as unhealthy.
Yes.
11 days. Why?
That's too long.
Either way. Jesus.
Oh, man. All right. Great laugh.
Yeah. Let's look further into that. I'm worried for the welfare of this individual. All right. I got one for you.
Where's Zach? Oh, is he there? Okay.
I'm here.
I love it.
Oh, God. Okay, I've got one for you real quick. Some facts about American geography. So I've got four for you. One, if you drive directly south from Detroit, you hit...
Austin.
New Orleans.
Canada.
Wait, oh. South.
You hit Canada
trick
first.
Question.
Yeah, trick question. Oh, I see what you guys have done. But yeah, no, it's you hit Canada because Canada kind of curves around and underneath Detroit. Second one for you. Portland, Oregon in the US is further north than Toronto in Canada. So Toronto is further south. Than
is that a true or false question? Or are you telling us?
I'm just telling you.
True.
Yeah. Ends up, yeah.
Given what happened with Zach's fact, I feel like there's no point in assuming you guys have any credibility.
I just want to say I did use AI for my fact, and it gave me the wrong fact.
He's blaming the robots. okay, number three. If you drive west from Nashville, Tennessee, which I think is fair to say is considered in the south, you run into Las Vegas. So Las Vegas is as far south as Nashville, Tennessee. And finally,
explains a lot.
Reno in Nevada is further west than Los Angeles in California.
Really?
Yeah, no, that's going to take a map. That's going to take a map for you to believe me.
Was that another AI fact?
Wait, look at pull up a map, gents. Pull up a map. I can't have folks on the podcast thinking I'm talking nonsense like Zach. Can you see it?
Oh, my.
Yeah, folks listening in, pull up a map too. There it is. Bang. Marcus Johnson. Bring in the truth. Wow. That's all we've got time for this episode. Thank you so much to my guests. Thank you to Oscar.
Thanks for having me, Marcus.
This week's winner of the game of the week. Thank you to Ethan.
Man, I don't know if I'm that grateful now, but you know, maybe I'll come back again.
We'll see. Thank you to Zach, of course, apart from that last, really the last 5 minutes.
Thanks, Marcus. I started strong, then the sleep caught up to me, and it all unraveled from there.
Really dragged down the whole show with that bit. Thanks, Zach. Thank you to Victoria, who edits the show, James, who copy edits it, and Stuart, who runs the team. Thanks to everyone for listening in. If you want to say hi to us on Instagram, we are moving. We are moving over to Insider Intelligence, one word. Insider Intelligence, one word, is where you can find us on Instagram. If you want to say hi, and we'll see you guys hopefully on Monday for the Behind the Numbers Daily, an eMarketer podcast made possible by Awin. Happy weekends.